All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove Supreme. Today marks the conclusion of what I feel is an instant classic episode, as I expressed in the previous recording, that I personally like one-on-one QLSs, meaning one artist to the show as opposed to group scenarios. So that way, you know, it's always, you get two sides of a story, of the same story sometimes, or you get the same identical story. But previous episode, we talked to one half, one of my favorite duos in music, one of the most successful duos in music. And now we are given the honor and the pleasure of speaking to the voice, the personal soundtrack of my childhood. And I'm, you know, a Philadelphian. So this episode is doing me some pride right now. What else can I say? But the one and only Daryl Hall.
Hey, hey.
Questlove Supreme. Welcome, sir.
All right.
By the way, Team Supreme, I'm sorry. I didn't even acknowledge your presence. How are you? Okay. Damn, you was waiting for that.
I was going to say it's okay. It's Daryl Hall. We're all a little fanned out. It's fine.
No. But in my mind, I'm still feeling like this is a continuation of the episode. But yes, we can let the world know that maybe a week or two went by. And, you know.
Yes.
So how are you doing, Laya?
I'm doing great. I'm ready. I'm so good.
You're excited.
Feel like this is, yeah, life is complete, man. It really
is. I got to ask something personal, even though this is inconsequential to our viewers who could only hear us and not see us, but I feel like every time you do an episode, you're doing it from another part of your house, or I see a new.
I said, this is actually my studio house.
Oh yeah, this is mine too.
Hey.
Okay.
Exactly. It is, Amir. It's my studio house.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm impressed with every episode. You seem to be in a new part of your house that I've never seen before. And
it's the only way I can get my Questlove Supreme brothers to truly come to my house. So yeah, this is the way I'm doing it. Maybe one day y'all come back.
Okay. Well, one of us will have to agree to get on a plane, but we'll say that for another episode.
Okay, you was here last week.
Unpaid Bill.
Yes, sir.
How's it going, sir?
Fantastic.
Congratulations to you.
How are you?
I'm great, man.
Congratulations to you.
You've been winning awards like hand over, whatever that expression is, and we have to do some flowers, Amir. Flowers for Amir. Congratulations.
I take them
with BAFTAs and
Back me with the flowers. Yes, thank you. Thank you for that deflection.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Well done.
Man. Well, you know, also you finished a milestone in the show that you're working on, Sesame Street. You finally finished, I guess, season 50, I assume.
We finished just last week, season 53, I think. 53.
Season 53. This is what I do want to know.
Wow.
Because I'm not an active watcher of Sesame Street now that I'm 51 years old.
Ooh.
As I was when I was a kid, but the death of Mr. Delgado, aka Luis on Sesame Street. Was he still an active character on the show, even up, or did he leave beforehand?
He left but came back a little while ago. He was back and forth, but he was like a definite presence. All of the humans sort of, all of the actors on that show sort of are always sort of omnipresent in that place, Bob and Emilio.
So like Maria, Bob, and Maria. Susan and Gordon, like they're still occasionally come back on the show to do stuff?
Yeah, like most recently they were around for season, we had a big reunion for season 50 a couple years ago, and they were definitely there for that, and I saw him at that, and he's a fantastic, like, Emilio, like, played the guitar really well and sang really well, and like, yeah. He was just a consummate musician and a wonderful human being, and it's really sad, but...
Yeah, you know, when you put me on the float, I think I got to meet some of them, and that was really cool.
You make it seem like I physically placed you upon the Thanksgiving Day float, and I will take full credit for that.
Well, I'm trying to give you props, Bill, because I don't want people to think that you're just like the Flavor Flav sidekick. Like you're a major staple in the circle, man. You are, you know, you're writing hit Broadway shows and producing platinum albums. And
just for the record, I'd be happy to be a Flavor Flav sidekick. I'm totally fine with that too. But that's very nice.
Oh, that's right, Bill. You're so hip hop.
I'm throwing some of these flowers back to you, Sugar Steve.
All right, flowers.
You okay? Even though you're upgrading your computer right now, you're doing this on your telephone.
I'm really good. Thanks for asking. I actually won a Schmucky Award last night, and I'm thinking about buying my own paper airplane.
Okay.
Lay it. Don't step on my punchlines in front of Daryl Hall.
Did you? I'm sorry. I didn't know you heard me. I'm sorry.
Anyway, Fontigolo. Good.
I'm good, brother. I'm good, man. I'm good. Congratulations to you, man. I was happy to see that straight
up. Thank you. Yes. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Now we can finally get to business. First of all, Sir Daryl Hall, are you in the world famous Daryl's house right now?
I'm in my studio house.
Okay, explain what that is.
So this is different than the Daryl's house that I've seen on television.
Yeah, it's a different house. An altogether different house.
That is baller shit. I like this. I like where this is going already. If you guys could see what we see right now, like maybe besides Will Smith, I've not seen a person be so imaginative with their surroundings
set up. Right.
Yes. This is the next.
I'm in the living room, man.
I'm
really too imaginative.
One light bulb.
Where I live.
One light bulb.
So as I said on the top of the show, we talked to your partner for over five, I don't know, maybe six decades, John Oates, about his musical experiences in his life. And now it's your turn because, you know, although you two share common ground, you two also have done different endeavors. And so I kind of wanted to make this more one-on-one instead of like the group project. So for you right now, like where do you call home? Where do you reside?
Right. I'm in Connecticut right here. I you know, I have a house in London too. So I kind of go back and forth.
Nice. What part of London?
In Kensington.
Nice. Okay. I used to live in Kentishtown.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Kentishtown in London. When did you cop a spot in London? When?
Yeah. I've been there since the 70s.
Oh, wow.
What?
Forever.
So you're a dual citizen?
Right, sort of.
Wow.
Why London? What made you choose to go over there?
I had an affinity for it just from the very beginning. It reminded me of Philadelphia in some crazy way.
Oh, wow.
We a little cleaner than that. Wait a minute. Now.
Well, yeah.
Well,
Some parts.
No. But you know what? He has a point because... The roots coming from Philly, we had to choose somewhere in Europe to live. And it was definitely something like, should we move to Paris? Should we move to Dunn's? And it was something about London that called us. And it's, so
there's something familiar about it, you know,
very much so. So thus, okay, well, that's cool to hear. Like, are you in the city part of London, or is it more like a quiet place, or like what? Because I know oftentimes artists will have their city residence and then they'll have a spot that, you know, is more quieter. I mean, I understand that now. Like, I never thought I'd be a person that would get a farm, but I just got a farm because I actually felt I'm more creative when I'm isolated and in silence. So for you, is having a dual housing situation more about like getting a spot that's quiet and then a part that's immersed in the city, or just
or just to have a city in Europe, just in case you just want to.
Well, it's actually kind of the same thing. I live out in the country here when I'm in America, and then my city house is in London, and I mean I have a, it's like a it's you know row house townhouse same okay. thing. Yeah.
So is it important as a creative for you to have a spot that's quiet and more isolated and allows you to be creative, or like again, as a newbie person that just purchased his spot? I mean, I did it because the pressure of the pandemic forced me to do it. But, you know, otherwise, I'd never understood artists that were like, yo, man, I need the country life is important. Like, I mean, I get the importance of silence now, but obviously you got this house that you're in now way before the pandemic. So what was the attraction of like, you know, I'm thinking like rock stars wouldn't want to be so isolated outside of the chaos and the hustle and bustle of what the industry was. So what was your decision to get a country spot?
I don't know, man. I've always sort of had one foot in the country and one foot in the city. I didn't grow up in Philadelphia. I grew up in Pottstown, you know, out in Chester County. And
I kind of consider that Philly adjacent.
It is.
Well, it is. But I'm an old guy. You know, it was the country in those days. It was really the country. And, you know, I grew up in a colonial house and all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it was, I grew up in that world. You know, my family were farmers, and, you know, so I grew up that way, but I was also part of the city. It's always been kind of schizophrenic with me. It's this city and a country together. And I sort of need both of them. I need one to balance out the other side.
Do you remember what your very first musical memory was?
Probably seeing my mother and father both were musicians. Seeing my mother in a band. I mean, my mother was in a band in Pottstown, and I was like, yeah. From the age of 2 years old, I'd watch the band, and I always wanted to be the band leader. You know, the guy that had he had like a white coat on. Everybody else had red coats on. He had a white coat on. So yeah, I wanted to be that guy.
What does Daryl Hall's mom's voice sound like? What is her singing voice?
She was a soprano. She's 98 years old now. And
wow. She's still here? Yes, she
still
is.
Here. What's up, man?
She still sings. But she's an amazing singer, amazing soprano. And my father was in a gospel group, a vocal group. And so I learned harmonies from him and his brothers and his friends and all that. So, I grew up in that whole world.
Were they closer to doo-wop or more Mills Brothers or like harmony? Like, what was their...
Church harmony, you know, like
quartet like, harmony.
Yeah, gospel harmony.
Okay, but when you say quartet, quartet, right? I'm thinking of below, you know.
I got you. I know what you're saying.
Right. Okay.
It was a quartet. See.
What's your sibling situation? How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have a sister. One sister. She lives up here in Connecticut too. And
is she musically inclined as well?
She is, but she's an artist. She does all my visuals. You know, she does everything from my album covers to my t-shirts to everything. Yeah.
Really? How long has she been collabing with you?
Well, as long as we've been alive.
Oh, so even in the days of like.
She was the visual artist and I was the singer. You know, we both do both things, but that's how it sort of panned out. Even when we were kids.
I know that I've seen you as a keyboard player. I believe I've seen you play guitar once or twice. But what was your first weapon of choice growing up as far as the instrument that you...
Piano. Yeah, when I was like 5 years old, I started taking piano lessons. But I was a singer before that. You know, my mom taught me how to sing because she was sort of a vocal teacher too. And she taught me how to sing from age zero. You know, I mean, I was always...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know that you have sort of history in Philadelphia proper. Yeah. So can you tell me what, like when you started gravitating towards metropolitan Philadelphia as opposed to outside of Pottstown? At what time did you start going to Philadelphia proper?
Sort of when I was a teenager, I would go in because they used to have trains in those days from Pottstown. So I used to go in and my friends were in there and I moved right out of high school. I moved to Philadelphia.
Okay. So you're talking about like the R5 or the R3, like those high-speed trains that SEPTA?
yeah, there was like the Reading Railroad and all that stuff.
Yeah. even when we asked John about the time that you guys put in during those years in the 60s in Philadelphia, he said that you would have more intricate stories because of your involvement with like Gamble and Huff and like all those groups around. But could you basically describe to me what the Philly environment was? I guess, you know, your teen years was in the 60s. So, you know, if you wanted to see your, like, of the acts of the day that you saw, like, where would you see them and what acts would you see of the day?
I used to go to the Uptown. I mean, I lived in the Uptown, basically. And I would see everybody there. And I got involved right away with Kenny and Leon. I actually did a talent show at the Uptown with this group I had, the Temptones, and we won the talent show. So I got a deal, and I went to Virtue Studios and did a record with the Romeos, with Kenny Gamble.
Ah, wow. With the Romeos. Yeah.
What year was this around?
It's 1967.
67. Gotcha.
You must have been a crazy extrovert, not very shy. Like, you sound like you were crazy confident from the jump, because to go into Philly and just dive in and just talk to folks.
You know what? I always had confidence in the music area. I'm not exactly, I wouldn't call myself an extrovert by any means. Okay. But when you get into music, then yes, suddenly I shine. I do have confidence.
And so was it unusual for you in the late 60s? Because I'm assuming that you're kicking it with the brothers in terms of, like, you know, if you're at the, you know, having met like Danny and the Juniors and the Dovells and those other like Philly doo-wop legends that were kind of around my father's era. Like, you know, I'm not hearing them tell me stories about, yeah, man, we used to always go to Uptown, whatever. But for you, was there not a novelty factor, but was it unusual for people to see a white guy be so immersed in soul in the mid to late 60s?
Mm-hmm. It didn't seem so unusual, believe it or not. It was a different time. I don't know, man. I mean, when you talk about the Dovells, they all went to Overbrook. I mean, those guys were in it big time.
Really? I'll be honest with you, because like a lot of my education just comes from like the revival shows that they were doing in the 70s and 80s, like past the, I don't know if I have a visual of any of the Philly legends in their prime, you know, late 50s, 60s, because obviously I wasn't born then.
But I knew those guys really well.
Okay. So
yeah, I knew Mike Frieda and Lenny Barry were really close friends of mine. And
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They were real, man. I mean, they came from the real thing.
Well, I got to ask an eyewitness. Have you ever seen my dad before? This is one of the weirdest questions I've ever asked on this show.
One of the first records I ever bought was your dad.
Boom.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
See, again, I only know the dad. I only know my dad from the second phase of his career, because there really wasn't documentation of, you know, of his career before then. So I can only go on word of mouth of, oh, I used to see your dad's all the time.
Well, shoot, Daryl got stories then. I want to know.
Well, yeah. So, okay, like, can you tell me what a typical lineup was in, if you were going to the Uptown in Philadelphia, which for our listeners out there, you know, there are a few houses for black acts that were quote unquote upscale in the Chitlin circuit. If you're in New York, the Apollo is a highlight. If you're in DC, the Howard. If you're in Chicago, is it the State Theater, I believe?
Yeah,
I think it's the State. Yeah, and if you're in Philadelphia, you're at the Uptown. Could you explain like what a typical bill would look like? Like, is it hosted by Georgie Woods? Is it, you know, is it an all day thing? Like, do you go there 12 in the afternoon? You stay till all the shows are over?
I used to do that occasionally. Yeah, I mean, it was whoever was popular at the time. You know, it would be anybody from like Billy Stewart, the Mad Lads, to, well, Gladys Knight and the Pips and the Temps, obviously, mm-hmm. and everything in between. I mean, it just depended who was, you know, who was touring at the time.
You know, my generation, if you go see
okay, Run DMC, you're expecting an hour show of just that act. But I mean, was there ever an act that, I mean, I know that James Brown was his own self-contained unit, but even he had a variety show. But was it just expected for like an act to come out and do 15 to 20 minutes and then that's it and you're out?
Yeah, that was usually the way it was. People didn't do long shows. It was usually some kind of review, you know, and a mixture of people, for sure.
Okay.
I never knew that's what review meant. Thank y'all. I never knew that it meant it was a time limit. When you say review, you're referring to a show.
Yeah. Like, you know, just from the days of like, well, I mean, most people.
Motown review.
Yeah. Or even like the modern era of like where Ma Rainey's.
Festivals. Right?
Yeah. Ma Rainey's Traveling Circus. And then that sort of, you know, morphed into vaudeville, which then morphed into the review, which I mean, at the time, only Motown and James Brown really had a strong enough presence to carry, you know, other people with them.
Multiple acts, yeah.
Yeah, back in the day, it was the radio guy. It was the Georgie Wood, you know, the Funk Master Flex of that period that would throw these shows and whatnot. So were you ever in a house band situation? Like, usually if we talk to New York guys and they say, like, you know, I was a backing band in the Apollo. Like, were you ever in a house band situation having to back these acts up when they came down?
I didn't do it at the Uptown. I did it at a couple other places in the Philadelphia area. I would do like I would play with the Stylistics or somebody like that. But I didn't do a lot of background play. No.
Okay, so if you're playing with the Stylistics, you know, I'm today it's easier for acts to, because of the internet, I can easily Google something. I can easily reference something. But in your day, how easy is it to pick up someone's music? Or is this just a thing where like you hear it on the radio a few times and you instantly know what the chords are? Like, do you get enough prep time to, I'm just trying to figure out the mind state of a person that is.
I mean, we used to do, I worked at Sigma a lot and did, you know, I did a lot of recording with people and just read chord charts. I mean, that was how you did it.
So you're a chord chart reader. Can you name some of the singles that you played on in those like early?
I used to work a lot. I can't even remember. I used to work a lot with Norman Harris. He was one of the guys, the guitar right. player, mm-hmm. and MFSB, you know, whatever. And so long ago, man. I remember doing a Clyde McFarrett record. You know, I mean, you know, like that's
right.
Sticks in my mind. We did a lot of stuff where we would do demos and it wouldn't even get anywhere. There was this guy, George Tinley. I used to work with him. I think I played on a Delphonics record.
Okay.
You think you played.
Was it a good living as, I mean, for you, like in that time period, was it for you? Like, is it a good living? Like, okay, I'm a session musician. Or did you instantly know, nah, it's in front of the microphone. Like that's where I want to be.
Yeah, I wanted to be in front of the microphone. I liked doing it, and it was an experience, and I learned it. And I would be like, you know, I was like third string or whatever, you know, but I was, you know, I was still in school, and I did a lot of writing too. You know, it was sort of a combination of studio work and writing at the same time. I worked with this guy, John Madera. We talk about Danny and the Juniors. He wrote At the Hop, you know, and he was,
really?
Yeah, he was at the Schubert building and he was on the sixth floor, and then Gamble and Huff were like a couple floors down. Tommy Bell was in there. So we all knew each other and hung out together. And so it was a combination of being in the studio and writing at the same time. Yeah.
Well, at the time period where Gamble and Huff sort of, or at least they dropped the anchor as the alphas in this Sound of Philadelphia thing, which always confused me because, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, not having the aid of liner notes, when I'm listening to, either their work or the work of, Dexter Wanzel or any of the other second string Philly International people, I'm assuming that, you know, this is all under the guise of
Gamble and Huff, only later to find out that they were just all using the same session musicians and had nothing to do with each other. But sonically, it all sounded like the sound of Philadelphia and Gamble and Huff. Did you ever at one point like try to approach them and say like, hey, I produce and I sing or songwrite, like, can I join the fray? Or was it instantly like, I want to establish my own thing and not be under?
Yeah, that's what happened, actually. Kenny actually said to me, would you like to come to Philly International and write and do whatever, you know, record? And that was just when I was getting ready to leave to move to New York with John. And I said, well, you know, I was tempted, I got to say. But I figured that what we wanted to do, what became the Hall & Oates sound or whatever, it was a Philly sound, but it wasn't the Gamble and Huff sound, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted to do my own thing, just what you said. I wanted to create my own version of Philly music. And so I turned that idea down, you know.
John had casually mentioned how you two had met, but I got to hear the details. He mentioned that I guess a fight had broken out at a show, and that's how mm-hmm. you two met. But could the you tell DAS us the story show? Of yeah. how you met?
Yeah, I mean, we've told that story so many times. I mean, singly and together.
Our listeners have not heard it. I guarantee you.
There was a record hop out in the Adelphi Ballroom in West Philly, and
on 52nd Street.
Yeah, and that's where it was. I forget who was on the bill. I remember Howard Tate was on the bill, Five Stair Steps, and then they had, you know, the bottom of the bill was the Temptones and John's band, we were waiting to go on. Those days shit happened, and some kind of fight broke out, and they closed the whole thing down, and it was up it was on a second floor, so we had to get an elevator, go downstairs to go to the street. And that's how I met John. He was in the elevator with me, you know, and I said, hey, what, you go to Temple University, blah, blah, blah. And we started kind of being friends, you know, hanging out.
Mm-hmm. What was your major at Temple?
Music.
Okay. Did they have an RTF program back then, or was that like?
Sure. Yeah, John was RTF, I believe. He was a journalism RTF kind of major, but I was a music major.
First of all, how many members were the Temptones? I know you guys were.
It was
Temptations influence, but
it was a revolving. We called it Temptones because of Temple University, not because of Temptations.
Oh wow! Okay, yeah. See, okay, I thought it was.
But it was revolving, but it was basically at the same time singing would be four people. Yeah, it was a quartet. Okay.
I get it. So. What was the deciding factor that told you like, okay, well, let me try this out, you know, leaving the, like, it's the Temptones only thing. It's like casual school stuff, casual Philadelphia stuff. And they weren't serious about it. Or were you more serious than they were?
Well, yeah, probably. I probably was, but it all just came out of street corner music. I mean, that's how it all started, you know, singing together. And then we decided to call it something. And it was various people coming in and out, and then we eventually got a little rhythm section to back us up, and John wound up being one of those people at the very, very end, and that's okay. How it sort of continued, you know, the whole it kind of morphed into just me and John working together and writing songs.
Okay. Like, as a singer, at least back then, like who was your North Star? Who, as far as like who you idolized as a singer, and then I guess who were you not emulating, but who do you felt like influenced your vocal style?
I mean, I was trying. I mean, Smokey loves, and then I loved all the singers of the Temptations. I was really into all that stuff. But a lot of street corner people, you know, your father, man, I loved him. Later, you know, Felipe Wynn, you know.
Oh, yeah. Spinners.
And these are the people that I idolize. That I guess when I was a kid, emulate. Yes, for sure.
Well, I meant just in terms of influence. That's all.
I was going to say, Costello mentioned Mr. Wind also from the Spinners as his, as like his all-time, you know, vocal idol.
There you go.
Yeah. No, he was a monster.
Daryl, can I just ask what your parents have were thinking on your journey? Like, did they expect you to just be an art? I mean, it's a blessing that you had two parents that were artists, but were they thinking that's where you were going to go, and were they happy about it?
They always supported me, there was never any question about it, to tell you the truth. They wanted to make sure I was going to, like, do something that I would make some money at, right? Hopefully. Right. But it was all, you know, they always supported me. Always.
That's so dope, man.
With John, was the chemistry with you guys on a, mostly on the songwriting tip, or was it a musical thing or vocal harmony kind of thing?
It was sort of songwriting more than anything. I was interested in what he was doing because he was way out of my realm of experience. You know, he liked bluegrass music and all the stuff that I'd never heard of. You know, or heard, I heard of, but I had never heard. And I was sort of, you know, I was in my student mode, so I was learning about all these things. And so I was really interested in what he brought to the table that way. So it was more of a friendship than anything else, to tell you the truth. I mean, we decided we were going to share a stage, but be very separate, which we've never changed. You know, he has his own musical style. I got my own one. We somehow fit it together when we worked together. But yeah, it was more, it really evolved from a friendship to something a little more than that.
The original Outkast.
Wow.
Yeah. Original Mobb Deep.
Yeah.
You both write music and you both wrote lyrics. And it was, how did that work?
Occasionally we would work together. That's how it worked. Like the song She's Gone, that's mm-hmm. I would call it exception to the rule, if you want the truth. John writes his own kind of songs, and I write mine. And occasionally we would collaborate on lyrics, and I would throw things at him. And I also collaborate with other people, like the Allen sisters. Sarah Allen and her sister Jana wrote a lot of songs with me. And John would jump into that too sometimes.
Are you protective of your work to the point where you're not easily persuaded or persuadable when it comes to, like, okay, if you submit a song, is it, you know, this is it, or is it, hey, why don't you try this idea? No, fix that around. I mean, I could see the producer doing that. I mean, in terms of, like, if Todd's producing or whatever, but, like, with you and Daryl, like, are you two allowed to offer unsolicited suggestions of a, you know,
absolutely. The reason I love collaboration, I like bouncing off ideas back and forth. John's participation in my songs is more like, what do you think of this? And then he'd say, well, why don't you try that or sing that or do that? But I would generate the song. Jana Allen would bring a song in and I would do that with her.
Okay.
You know, works like that. Yeah, very flexible. Very flexible.
Okay.
You mentioned She's Gone, but I don't think we got to hear you when you broke down the workflow of that song.
We sat and wrote that. John came up with a chorus, and it was sort of a more folky kind of style. And I said, okay, why don't we do it this way? And I started playing that piano riff that is the signature of the song. And I did all that. And then we sat down and we wrote lyrics about it. I mean, that was a real Hall & Oates song. We sort of pooled our experiences that were things that were going on with both of us separately at the time, and we kind of mixed it together and turned it into what the lyrics are of that song. And then we took it to Atlantic when we played it for Arif. He's the one that put that crazy modulation idea into it.
How does a group pursue a record deal in the 70s? You know, now we're in a time where you can go viral on YouTube, someone sees it, and chances are they'll stalk you and see what your situation is and sign to me. But how do you gain the attention of the industry? Like, when you and John are like, all right, we're going to do this, what's the step in the process of getting a record deal?
we you know, we knocked on doors in New York City, and everybody liked us. And then we'd get the word, well, they liked you, but they, you know, they turned us down. Well, so we went, long story short, we actually went to L.A. and we went out there and we were knocking around. We were introduced to some people, and I was introduced, John and I were introduced to this guy named Earl McGrath. Earl McGrath, who had this tiny label, that was an indie label subsidiary of Atlantic, and it was called Clean Records. And Earl wanted to sign us. He liked what he heard, and he said, "Okay, I'll sign you." And then he took it back to New York, and we auditioned for Ahmet and Arif. And I remember I had the flu, man. They gave me this piano where all the notes were sticking on it, and it was the worst audition in the world. And whatever happened, Arif really liked it. Ahmet really liked it, so they basically stole us from Earl, and we wound up going to Atlantic, and that's how we did it.
My dad mentioned what we commonly say as a showcase. I don't know if showcases are as common now as they were back then. But when you're saying we audition, is it a thing where you book a gig at the Bottom Line or a club and they come see you? Or are you in a confined SIR situation? Or I know like Atlantic has their own facility and room like that. Like, do you set up there and then you just perform for 10 suits in a room? Is that process more jarring and weird? Like, to.
Yeah, it was really. Like I said, all the conditions were the worst. We were in this little room with this shitty mm-hmm. piano. I mean, with the key sticks stuck, and across from me on the other side of the room was Ahmet, Arif, and I don't think it might have been Jerry Wexler. I can't remember, but wow. They were all sitting there watching us, and it was just me and John, and I'm playing like I can't even remember what I played, and I thought it went terribly, but I guess they saw something, you know, they saw through it all. And that's how it was. It was a really personal audition.
Can you talk about, you know, Mr. Martin is one of my idols because one of my favorite groups ever was The Average White Band. So having read his name on, you know, on Average White Band and Aretha Franklin and Donny Hathaway, can you talk about working with Arif Martin as far as his production style and what was it like for you?
He was the greatest producer, man. I mean, in my opinion, Arif and Quincy are the two great producers of all of the era. And Arif allowed the artist to do, he was so flexible. I can't even describe it. It was he allowed you to shine. He had this uncanny ability to figure out what it is that you were good at doing and where the spark was and developing that spark. And he could add all kinds of. He had no boundaries at all. He would mix genres. He would mix eras. Yeah. Everything all at once together. Whatever the song needed. Or he thought it would need, he would just add it. And he had an incredible, like an encyclopedic knowledge of every kind of music. And it was a really amazing, and he was such a gentle guy, but yet he knew how to drive the bus. And he was an amazing producer. That's all I could say about it.
Was he hands-on in terms of soup to nuts? As far as picking the songs, picking the mixer, staying there for the mix, sequencing your album, suggesting singles, like when he takes on a project, is he literally watching every iota of it? Or is it like, okay, guys, I won't be here next week, but that like Jerry's going to sit in for me. I got to work with Aretha for this thing. Or is it like once he's on your project, it's just you and you alone? Or are you scheduled in between other stuff?
No, he would do it one at a time. And you mentioned Average White Band, who are good friends of mine. He went directly from Carly Simon to Hall & Oates to Average White Band. That was the three things that a row he did at that period of time. But he would devote whatever it was to each one. He didn't mix and match.
Because I was wondering if he loses his ears, like if he's working with you on Thursday and then he has to, you know, start doing pick up the pieces tomorrow. Like, is it possible for him to lose his ears or?
Well, the flow of it? I don't think it was, because he had the ability to do that. He would just switch projects. But he didn't. You mentioned before, he didn't have anything to do with picking singles or anything. He would A&R it. I'd sit there and play songs for him, and he said, "Well, this is a good one. Are you okay? Yeah, let's work on this." And he would do that, and then develop the song from beginning to end.
Okay.
But then, and once the song was done, then it was over. You know, he had nothing to do with like, this is a good single. That was for other people, which is the way it should have been, to tell you the truth.
So a song like She's Gone, which is full of drama.
Yeah.
And of course, once you get to the payoff key of that modulation build, you got to sell that She's Gone. Like, how is he nurturing as a producer in terms like that? Or is it like, do it again, do it again, do it again? Like,
no, that particular one, that was just, what can I say? That was just inspiration from me. I just did that. I just opened my mouth and that's okay. I can't even that note anymore, by the way. But
and he lets you suggest things, and
he let it happen. He let it happen. He went, oh, that was really good. You know, afterward he was saying, yeah, that was the shit. He didn't even think about saying, can you do that again? It was there. It was what
I know the story of She's Gone is that, you know, not many people know that the Tavares brothers from Boston actually took that song to the top 10 before you guys did, even though your version is, and now in our minds, the definitive version. But were you kind of confused or perplexed that your first hit single was actually a cover song of your song?
Yeah, it was a weird thing. It's a long time ago, but our enthusiasm,
right,
overrode our frustration, if you know what I mean by that.
But like, is it like seeing your girlfriend with another guy, or is it just like, hey, I'm in the top 10 and I wrote this song, so here comes the money?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I was pissed off, because I just felt that was the way of the world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any expectations. Whatever happened, I rode the horse with whatever direction it was going in. And if Tavares has a hit with it, okay, well, I wish it was me, but it was them. So that's all I could say, you know.
What was the decision behind working with Todd on the War Babies record and not staying with Arif to see if you guys can go further with it?
I felt that I wanted to do something completely different. I don't know what my mindset was in those days. I moved to New York City. I wanted to sort of like expand my musical world outside of my Philadelphia, you know, that the Philly sound thing. And I wanted to go completely different. I don't know why I did, but I did. And I thought that maybe working with Todd would be a good thing, because he did the same thing. He's a Philly guy that left New York and created his own musical world. And I thought that it would be interesting to see what would happen if he would get together with us and what would come out of it. And that was really what it was all about.
And were you an immense fan of his early records or the albums that he was doing at the time?
Yeah, I liked what he was doing. I really liked what he was doing at the time with Utopia. It was really
okay. Well, having discovered his discography 20 years after the fact, you know, I discovered him once. It's already established that this guy is like a crazy genius. But at the time when it's coming out, you know, was it unusual? Because I mean, Todd's whole canon is really, it was forward thinking for the time period, because he's like, one of the examples of what we now call the bedroom musician. Of course, we're used to it now, post-Prince, and now anyone practically today is a bedroom musician, but that was like really unusual back then. And he would push the buttons creatively on all of his records. Was he ever trying to pass his zany ideas on to you guys, like, you know, to really push the edge of art as far as it can go?
Well, I was into that headspace, so he didn't have to push me. I was right there with him. I said, "How far can we go?" That was the whole idea.
And how receptive was Atlanta to this at the time?
Not that receptive.
Okay.
Hence RCA.
I get it. Can you talk about Sarah Smile and just the inspiration behind it?
It's
one of your most loved songs, you know.
Sarah Allen, me, and John were sharing an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment in Yorkville. And I had a keyboard, and I just played the song. You know, I was writing the song. It just came out of real life. I mean, I can't say more than that. I just wrote the song about what was going on around me.
I mean, was she receptive in these flowers that you're, I'm now mocking a unpaid bill. Was he receptive, or was it like cringy? Like, ah, man, like now you're going to immortalize me for the rest of the, like, what was her feeling towards this song? And actually, how did you guys meet?
We met at Philadelphia. John met her and introduced me to her. She worked for a charter airline, and that's where the Las Vegas turnaround came from. And we all decided to move to New York at the same time. It was like that.
Could she sing?
She can sing. She's not a great singer, but she can sing. And she's actually a really good songwriter.
Wow.
Yeah.
In retrospect, since you didn't know it was going to be such a hit song, would you have changed the name if you would have known you'd be singing the song so often?
Oh, man, I don't know. You know, after Sandy and I split up, man, she said she couldn't go to the supermarket for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, I was going to say, how awkward is it? How awkward is it if, like, I'll never sing that song again if you guys break up and, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, that song transcends relationships and all that. It's bigger than that, you know.
And every Sarah in the world thinks it's just about her, so it's great.
That's true.
So the time period between the silver cover, the Daryl Hall and John Oates self-titled record with Sarah on it. Yeah. Between that and, you know, between, I think, Faces, you know, there was kind of a period, or not Faces, Voices, forgive me. In 80, that 5-year period where, you know, you guys weren't exactly sticking in terms of finding an audience that's receptive to you. Just between that period, what was it like between 75 and 80?
Well, we had Rich Girl first.
Well, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. But in music, it was a transitional time. There was that weird shit going on, you know, rock versus disco and all that. And man, that put us in a really strange place, because it was a time of categorization and what's cool and what's not cool and all this stuff. And, it was hard to figure out how to maneuver through all that. It was a really strange time, and it seemed like in 1980 it turned around and something else happened. Also, we started producing ourselves, and that changed. I don't know. I think the world changed and we changed.
So, having spoken with our previous QLS guest Denise Williams about her experiences, I know that David Foster produced the Along the Red Ledge record and the Static record. What was it about? What was it? One, what was it like working with David Foster? And, you know, I'm trying to, It's weird because whenever David Foster enters the picture for any artist, at least between the period of like the late 70s to the mid 80s, it's rather controversial. But, you know, as far as his work with Earth, Wind & Fire, Denise Williams, Chicago, like whenever there's a documentary, it's always like, and then David Foster came and it's like, dun, 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 and he always drastically changes the sound. So, one, why did you guys choose David Foster? And, you know, what was that experience like working with him?
Well, actually, Tommy Mottola chose him. So,
Okay. Well, let me ask you. Well, at the time, I mean, he wasn't the Tommy Mottola I grew up knowing, like the established CBS, you know, executive. How did you guys discover Tommy Mottola?
I've known Tommy since he was 20 years old. He was working at Chapel Music. He was our first manager. We were a trio. It was Mottola, me and John, and that's, I mean, he was our manager.
I can't imagine Tommy Mottola as a teenager.
He was pretty much the same, just younger.
And how was he good enough to be your manager as a teen? Like, how did you see that in a teenager?
Yeah, what did he show y'all? Yeah.
He's one of those people who just acts like a manager, even if he's a kid.
Yeah.
So gotcha. Was he managing guys from the beginning, the very beginning?
Yeah, we were his first project or whatever you want to call it. We were a team. It was me, John, me and Tommy. And it was that way all the way up till he discovered Mariah, man. And then he dumped me.
Wow. Wow.
Soundbite for yes. Okay.
Everybody's always talking about the Hall & Oates albums and rightfully so, but you also release solo records. And in 77, you worked with Robert Fripp on Sacred Songs. So can you tell us what was the impetus for releasing a solo project in that year? And what was the story? It took like 3 years for it to come out.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons we're talking right now is because I have a whole project that I'm releasing all my solo records. I have a whole like parallel universe of music that I've been doing since the 70s. To talk about Robert, Robert and I became friends, and we just decided we were going to try and see what would happen if we worked together. And we did that album in 70, what was it, 78, 77. Immediately ran up against the machine that was unreceptive to the idea that I was not doing Rich Girl Jr., you know, and was doing something different, and they didn't want to hear about it, and that's been sort of a recurring theme with whenever I do my projects. It always sort of takes the back seat to the cash cow, and very frustrating. And
you ever wanted to keep a song for yourself, or are you basically just saying that?
Well, I write for projects. I write for projects. Okay. No difference to me. It depends on who I'm working with. So I don't think I ever said I'm going to hold this song for a solo record or hold this song for a Hall & Oates record or anything like that. I work for projects.
You know, one of the very first sounds of a drum machine that I've ever heard was, I mean, at the time that I was aware of it, was I Can't Go For That. As far as like technology is concerned and all those things, like for you, can you just explain how intricate or how involved you were with like finding new sounds and whatnot? I don't know if it's like you purposely wanted to find a new sound, but you know, I Can't Go For That was such a radical sound than what was kind of the standard for what was sonically the standard for music. Can you just explain that process? I mean, so stripped down, but so timeless at the same time.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. It happened by accident. There was no plan. I sat down and I turned on a Roland CompuRhythm, which is the simplest drum machine that you could ever imagine. And I pushed Rock and Roll 1, which is that beat. And I started playing. I had this Korg organ, and I started playing the bass line to it, and then I started playing the right hand to it. And that's where the song came from. I mean, it all just happened spontaneously. And there was no plan to, I was just using what was in front of me. It was really like that.
You mentioned Quincy Jones earlier, having worked with both of them. Are there any stories or experiences from that? How surreal was that night doing USA for Africa?
Well,
I know that you were part of the We Are the World recording.
It was one of the weirdest things that I've ever done in my life.
Talk about it. Yeah,
let's go. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I mean, the whole idea is that you're not allowed to bring anybody in with you into the room. So that's a big change for most people, you know, because everybody's got their people that they walk around with and they hang with and they depend on and do whatever. And no one was allowed in the room except for the actual artists that were performing and working. So we were all in there together and didn't know everybody. I mean, it was an outrageous group, assemblage of people. I mean, it was like Ray Charles sitting at the piano and Diana was there and Tina Turner and I mean, on and on and on. And nobody knew how to act because
it was awkward.
It was awkward. So everybody reverted to being like an eighth grade chorus because we're all standing on those, you know, the
bleachers.
And that's how people started acting. They started acting like kids. And everybody's like making these weird kind of like kid jokes and stuff and asking each other for their autographs and all this kind of thing. And really being really open. I've never seen a group of artists be so open with each other as we all were that night. And it went on too. It went on well into the night. You know, some people were still there at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And, It was crazy. It was a crazy experience.
In cutting those vocals, is it intimidating, like doing it in front of other artists, or are you the kind of guy that needs to be isolated in a room alone to give your best performance? Like, what's your modus operandi? What do you prefer?
Well, actually, I like doing it in front of people. It works. It works for me. I mean,
so that pressure is good for you.
Yeah, it makes me do my best work. I just opened my mouth and said that little bit that I did. I just sang it. That was it, you know, one take. But some people had to redo their stuff.
We heard.
Everybody was different, you know.
I get it. I would also like to ask you about the Apollo record with Eddie and David. Well, okay, you told me that Temptones were more based on tempo. I always swear it was from the Temptations, but could you describe your fandom for the Temptations, like, and how was that a special moment, or was it just like, okay, that was cool? And
no, it was one of the special moments. I mean, you're hitting on all the things that actually matter. Yeah, with the Temptations were Temple University, but I idolized the Temptations, and I got to know them back in those days. Wow. There's a picture of me with those guys back then in 1967, and I really did get to know them all and hung out with them, sang with them, did all that kind of stuff. I was especially friends with Paul Williams and Eddie.
And you knew Paul Williams?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh God, please. I've never heard a Paul Williams story in my life. Can you just describe?
One time I took him to Linton's Diner out in West Philadelphia in Overbrook Park. And I was the celebrity of the evening, man, because I brought him into this fucking diner.
Oh yeah, everybody was like, "Yo!"
You brought Paul Williams because, you know, everybody was a Temptations fan, and I brought him into the place, man. And yeah, I really like Paul. I had a lot of heart to heart talks with Paul, man, and he used to listen to the records and listen to my songs and stuff.
I was just about to ask you, what did some of the guys think of your voice and what you did? Like, what did the Temptations say about that?
I sometimes after hours, I'd go in one of their rooms or whatever, and they'd all sit around and sing. And
wow.
David was never there. He was always somewhere.
Yes.
So I'd take David's parts, and I'd sing the whole.
Really?
And they would say what? I feel like I want to know about the first time they heard your voice. And there's like, what? Well,
I guess they saw what it or heard what they heard, you know. I mean, that's all I can say.
Yeah, the fact they let you come in the room, that says it all.
Yeah, I mean,
that's true too.
One of the double beds, you know, and sing songs.
Shit. Damn.
Wow. That's okay. So, I mean, for me, that's like to make an album with my idol, you know, that is special. I'm glad that was a good experience for you. Any memories of the Three Hearts and a Happy Ending Machine record? I know that by that point, even though you two will have made like one or your final, at least of that Hall & Oates run, the one for Arista, in making that record and working with David Stewart and oh my God, I didn't even mention T-Bone, your bass player and your musicians. What was that for you? What was that process like?
Well, Dave and I, again, I tend to work with people that I get friendly with first.
Okay.
Dave and I got friendly and we started writing songs together right away. I mean, we're still really close friends. And it was very natural. You know, he had his own studio in London. And actually, we started it in Paris because he just wanted to do something different. And we wound up doing a good part of that album in Paris. But T-Bone was sort of in the middle of it all. He was the voice of reason. Because Dave is very, he and I are very similar. You know, we just go for it, you know, and it's all over the place. It's very loose and spontaneous. Mm-hmm. And T-Bone was sort of holding down the fort. And he was the voice of reason within it all. And so that's what it was like. It was a lot of fun making that record.
How did you guys induct him? You know, even before like we got to know musicians or whatnot, you guys had like a really charismatic band. So, you know, I knew of T-Bone. I knew of your guitarist.
G.E.?
It was
G. Smith.
G. Smith. Those cats. Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Like, how did you guys assemble that particular band? Were they just like New York's finest? And do you knew already?
It happened. Let me think. G was working with Dan Hartman. Okay. And now don't ask me how that all happened.
Oh, Instant Replay Dan Hartman? Okay.
Yeah, that Dan Hartman. And then... And Dan wasn't working, so somehow GE, man, I can't remember. Somehow he got introduced to me, and I said, "Do you want to join the band?" And I brought him in, and who else was playing? Jerry Marotta, yeah, Jerry Marotta was playing drums with us, right?
Okay.
So it kind of happened gradually, and then we were looking for a bass player, the guy that we were using couldn't do it anymore. Oh, it was John Siegler. He went back to Todd or something because he was working with Todd Rundgren. And T-Bone auditioned. And yeah, there he is, man. I said, well, this guy's a monster. And so
I forgot to mention on John's episode, but well, I mentioned that when you guys were coming on the Tonight Show, and unfortunately you had to cancel because T-Bone had passed away.
Yeah.
2 days before, I forgot to also mention, at least for our fans, that that's T-Bone. That's the bass player on Curtis Blow's The Breaks.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a legendary, yeah. Legendary cat.
Yeah. He did that before he joined us. That was his first thing he did. He did. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I did not know. After the initial implosion of Hall & Oates, like how hard was it to come to that decision after the Oh Yeah record and you guys going your separate ways to do your solo endeavors? Like, did you know that at least that initial run of Hall & Oates from 72 to 88, that you had enough at that point? Like,
it only looks that way when you look back on it. I mean, when we were in it, we just said, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. We never really stopped making records. We made records through the 90s.
Well, I know you did it, but it was always billed as like a comeback record or like a reunion album.
It was more other people's perceptions than ours. But okay. We sort of morphed into just this, into a touring band. And that's really what we are now. You know, we're a performance band. We don't really, you know, we have this outrageous body of work that we can draw from. And that's really where we come together at this point. And it sort of, it just turned into that. And we decided to be more individuals, which is what I think tends to happen as you go on in life, you want to become more yourself. And it's part of maturity or whatever, and knowing yourself. And that's where we're at right now, you know?
Y'all are still good friends and still like work, but just not recording. Yeah, just touring.
If I'm going to make a record, I'd rather make a record with me. And he feels the same way. We do it.
I get it. I completely get it.
Fronte's kind of in that situation himself, right?
I understand.
So are you, Amir, in a whole different way? Like, it's like the it's interesting. I'm looking at Fronte and his group situation. I'm looking thinking about you and Black Thought and existing separately in your projects. It's kind of interesting.
But the thing is that the roots, like for me, like Tariq and I have an agreement that we can go and scratch our back. Like we're in a polyamorous relationship. Mm-hmm, so if I need to get my back scratched elsewhere, I know that at the end of the day, I'm going to come home and, you know, sort of come back to home base eventually, like check in. Hey, you okay? Da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, I guess for a lot of times there's this thing where it's like, if you're in a group situation that you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And then there's always the thing where you miss it in 8 years. You're like, all right, let's rebuild the house again. You know, I just always wonder.
And then
about
you
that.
Start realizing why you left the house to begin with. It's like, nah, I should stay gone.
Yeah. Well, okay. Can I ask I understand this might be a personal question, but in a situation where I'm certain that you can't be partners with someone for that long of a time without it being arguments or whatever, or at least with a duo, it's kind of different when it's in a group dynamic, but do you two at least have your version of not going to bed angry?
Yeah. You
or make sure that you're clear.
Yeah. Yeah. What does conflict resolution look like for you guys?
We don't really fight. It's a funny thing. I mean, again, we've known each other since we're kids. I think we sublimate it. I think there's a lot of, maybe there's resentment and shit under the surface that doesn't come out, but we don't, we never fight. That's the best way I could put it. We just don't fight. We either let it go or bury it.
I see. I have a question about your Philly home, your house on Quint Street, the one in Philly that still remains. You know, why was that, you know, a perfect creative enclave for you and John?
It was the time. There's something about that period of time. Hmm. I got that place. I was married to this girl at the time, and I was right out of school, and it was really a good time to be in Philadelphia right then. It was great music and just a great atmosphere. And that house was great. That was the Hall & Oates birthplace, really.
Right. Okay.
That's all I can say about it. I love that house. I renovated it, actually. Yeah.
For a whole new generation of fans, a lot of them had their discovery of you via your legendary show, Live from Daryl's House. Uh-huh. Which, you know, what was the sort of, what was the genesis of the idea of that, of you inviting guest over to jam and whatnot? And
yeah, that was the OG Tiny Desk.
And is it streaming or what? Because
it's not it right now. I'm waiting to restart it again.
I'm waiting for my invitation.
You ain't got it. Oh, Daryl. Oh,
anyway.
I think I actually did give you an invitation,
and we were on tour. Ooh. Yes, you're right. I forgot.
Ooh, wow. Dear.
Yes, we were. Mm. I forgot we were on tour. Forgive me. I have my own face. Sorry.
My phone started up again in some form, for sure.
But Daryl's House is operational all year round, right?
Well, you mean the club, Daryl's House?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in Pawling, New York. Yeah.
Right. My sister lives in Westport, and she wants her own table there. She's there every show.
Yeah, I love having a club. I love clubs.
But seriously, Daryl, can you see old episodes anywhere? I was literally just thinking about that today, because it was on an interesting network in the first place.
Well, can you see the episodes?
Can you see the old episodes? Yeah, can you see the old
episodes? Your archival.
Yeah.
Not all of them. Not my plan is to make them all available.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Gotcha. You'll get that deal. Yes. 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 Yes.
What were the 2 years of lockdown and quarantine like for you? Were you able to go into other forays of creativity in terms of like?
No, I went into hibernation. The studio house is where I lived, and I stopped making music. I didn't do anything because I had this feeling that when this whole thing blew over, that it was all going to be different. And I knew it was going to be different for me. Mm-hmm. And a lot of reevaluation and I've been traveling my whole life. You know, I've been on the road my whole life, and to be in one place in lockdown, I just sort of embraced it. That's the best way I can put it. I just said, okay, here I am. I'm not seeing anybody but my sister who lives up the road. And that's really what I did for all that time. And
this was the longest that you've ever taken a break from not doing music,
since I was a teenager. Yeah, for sure. And when I realized that we were coming out of it, I said, okay, now what am I going to do? It's reevaluation. I think a lot of people were thinking that way. Mm-hmm. But the way I'm looking at my life, my career, my creativity, everything. And that's why I'm putting out this body of work album to start it. It's sort of it's a new era to me. And whatever I wanted to do, I'm doing now. I'm not holding it back. I'm not letting circumstances dictate anything. I used this term before, but I'm going to just ride the horse direction it's going in.
I know that another area of creativity for you is like restoring houses and whatnot. Is that therapeutic for you?
Yeah, it's therapeutic. It's I love history. I love all that stuff. You can tell by this room that I'm in, but it's sort of like making music. It's antique architecture is what it's all about with me.
Oh, okay.
And restoring old places and bringing them back to their period, what they were in their period, and working with all these artisans and artists, which is like working with musicians and getting teams together and making a project happen, making something out of nothing. It's not unlike making a record. It's, okay. It's sort of the same thing.
Is there an HGTV show I don't know about? Or
I did do a TV show about restoring an old house.
You said you did?
Yeah, I did.
I thought it sounded familiar. Okay.
Restoration overhaul.
Okay. That sounds familiar. Okay.
Yeah.
Your before after project, could you tell us like the inspiration behind it and the creative process to create it?
Well, I wanted to put together my alternative body of work. Everybody knows my work with John, but not as many people know all these things that I've been doing for all these years. And I wanted to bring it out into the world, you know, and I took excerpts from every album and included excerpts from the Life of Daryl Sass show and put them all together. I didn't do them in chronological order. I treated them the way I would treat any kind of album and just put the songs together as I felt the flow. And that's the best way I could put it. I just showing the world that side of my music and the people that I worked with and all these different projects I've been doing for many, many years.
The ultimate mixtape for you, like the ultimate retrospective of your favorite songs, your personal favorites from your solo catalog.
Yeah, all the ones that are my first, the ones I think are the great, the best of the best, you know. And that's an introduction. It's a reintroduction to some people, but it's an introduction for a lot of people. And then I'm going to continue on with this and start making original songs. I'm already working on new songs with various people.
There's a version. There's a producer named Pomo. He did a version of I Can't Go For That. Have you heard it? I think it's on Spotify. He like did like a, that shit is hard as fuck. It's Pomo? Like a Pomo. He did like a, it's kind of like a house kind of fourth to the floor version of I Can't Go For That.
Yes. It's still a groove, I spin though. It every time. Yes.
Yeah. That shit is a jam. I think you dig it.
Are you familiar with people dipping into your past and sort of reintroducing your music to.
Because they, I have to approve them, number one. So, I hear what people are doing. And I love it when people mess around with my songs. I think it's great.
Daryl, I always wanted to ask you, what do you think after you guys did your thing and, of course, changed the way Philly music is looked at? What do you think about after you left and some of the other Philadelphia artists that came after you? Have you noticed anybody that locked in your ear? Or?
I don't know. Anybody, I'm trying to think of any.
It's like the, you know, so many eras. It was, of course, I mean, I ain't gonna say the Roots because, you know, so and so is here, but as in, you know, the music soul childs, the Jill Scotts, the
I'm Legend,
John Legends, well, College Philly.
Everybody knows, yeah. I mean, they're all great. I mean, okay. They're carrying on the tradition, man.
Before I go, I definitely want to ask you about these tour dates. Like for you, do you like touring still, or? Is the grass always greener on the other side? Like for you at this stage in your life, when you see, cause you're about to do like a 3 month or 2 to 3 month run for your solo tour. Like for you, is it like getting up at like the idea of lobby call and early stuff and sound check and a routine? Is that, you know, is it still exciting to you, or is it just like, I don't know.
Well, it's, you know, when you're out there, you go like, oh fuck. Yeah. You know, it becomes hurry up and wait. It's, you know, it's routine. It's constant, you know, moving around, doing all that. But when you're on stage, a bird's got to sing, you know, I mean, it just feels like it's if you're having a good night, your monitors are good and everything's working. It's a spiritual experience. That's the best.
I know you're hitting Carnegie Hall. Is this the first time that you're playing Carnegie Hall as a solo act?
First time I'm playing Carnegie Hall with anybody act. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's what's up, man.
I have one final question from me, Daryl. And this is not, you've probably heard this before. It's not an original question.
Okay.
And it's not a joke. We're a lot of us out here still waiting for Rock and Soul Part 2. You know, as promised by the calling the original Part One. So what's wrong with releasing another edition of that, a Part Two, with just deeper cuts from your immense catalog with John?
I think it's a good idea. Maybe I'll do it.
There you go.
Not a bad idea.
I have a question in closing. And I guess I should have asked it earlier. I mean, when people mention you, of course, you know, the term blue-eyed soul always gets tagged with you. When you think of blue-eyed soul, at least if you're kind of my age, the first thing you think of is Hall & Oates. Did you guys mind this tag at the time, or was it, I think every artist sort of collectively rolls their eyes of whatever like is pegged of them. But, you know, when the term blue-eyed soul came up, like, I feel like you guys were sort of the first out the gate to get that title. Like, did you mind it, or was it like, I hate that term?
Well, the first duo that ever got it was the Righteous Brothers. That's where,
that's
where it all came from.
That I did not know.
That makes
okay.
sense.
Righteous Brothers was, that's where the term, that's whoever, I don't know what journalist used it, but that's where it all came from. Mm. I'm not nuts about it. I'm a soul singer. I have blue eyes. Oates got brown eyes. Whatever, you know, I don't like to break categories down, especially those kind of categories.
I see.
Do you feel the honor in existing, thriving, and being an example in soul music in that way, though?
I'm happy to be respected in a world that I care about. And it's my baby food. It's what I grew up with. It's the source of my musical inspiration. So I mean, no matter what the production or the arrangement or even the song is, I'm still a soul singer in my heart. And that's where it generates from.
Wow. We're hearing that much these days. Bonnie Raitt said that, and about the blues, and John said that, and Costello said that.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, if that's what you grow up on, that's what you are.
That's right. That's absolutely true.
Well, hey, I just have to say, you know, you guys are, I mean, you in general, like you're the soundtrack of, you know, my life as a music fan and in general. And I'm really pleased and happy that we did this episode. And I thank you very much, Daryl, for doing this with us and making this a special episode. Well, Daryl Hall, ladies and gentlemen, legendary Philadelphian. And you know, this, wait a minute.
T.U.
One more question, please.
What?
One more question, and I swear to God, I'll let you go. I heard a rumor that you once stopped a robbery from happening once on tour.
Yeah.
Is this true?
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
How? I've heard the rumor of it, but never.
Tell the story.
I'll tell you the story.
This is the encore, and I promise it's over.
Right. Because nobody ever asked about that. The first time that me and John went to Australia, right? We were in Melbourne, Australia.
Uh-huh.
And it was after a show, and we went to this restaurant, and nobody was there except for, it was after hours, and nobody was there except these two guys and their wives were sitting at a table next to us, and my bass player, his girlfriend, John, and one of our minders. So it was, you know, some guy that was with us. And so we're sitting there, and suddenly this guy, we look up, and there's a guy standing with a ski mask and a shotgun.
Oh, shotgun.
What year was this?
This was 1981, I'll say, something like that.
82. Jesus Christ, this is Private Eyes time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. Okay.
So the guy, he starts waving the gun around, and he says, you know, give me your money. And I remember the bass player, his name was Kenny. He pulled out a credit card and handed him a credit card. Okay. And so we're all sitting there, and it's unreal. I mean, anybody, you ask anybody in a situation like that, it's all very unreal. The guy had a ski mask and a shotgun. Right. And he goes over to the next table, which was right next to us. And he starts pointing the gun at one of the women and says, give me your money out of your purse. Right. And he put the gun down just enough that one of the guys grabbed the barrel of the gun and pulled it. And the other guy jumped on him. And then John jumped up and jumped on the guy. And then we all started jumping on this guy, and I tried to jump on him, and the bass player's girlfriend grabbed me around the leg and pulled me back and says, save me. So I couldn't do anything because I'm fighting. She's like a little puppy dog or whatever. And I'm trying to fight her away and grab this guy at the same time. We basically broke the shotgun up, took the shells out, and then okay, he was disarmed. So then we held him. And by then the maitre d' or whatever it was, the guy that was there, had called the cops. The cops come charging up the stairs because they were on the second floor, and grabbed the guy and basically threw him down the steps and then took him away. And apparently he had robbed 25 restaurants, and he was called the Rusty Gun Bandit.
Wow.
Rusty,
ladies and gentlemen, that sounds like you stopped Samuel Jackson from robbing.
Right, McDonald's. I was thinking the same thing, Fonte. I was like, "This is pre-Beverly Hills Cop and Coming to America." Okay.
Yeah. Daryl Hall, legendary Crime Stopper, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, man.
Yo, dog. That's how you end the show.
Yeah.
Pay Bill, Laia, Sugar Steve, Fontigolo, and I'm Questlove, the legendary Rock and Roll Hall of Fame God himself, Daryl Hall. Thank you very much,
sir.
This is Questlove.
Thank you, everybody.
We'll see you on the next go round. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Daryl.
Questlove.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.